Welcome to Oncology Today, the management of HER2-altered non-small cell lung cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Bob Lee from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. To begin our conversation, I asked Dr. Lee to review the evolution of targeted treatment for patients with non-small cell lung cancer.
It really started, at least in lung cancer, from the EGFR story back in, that was almost two decades ago. And the Tom Lynch paper was really a major landmark publication, a sea change. It took another 5 years or so before it got translated into saving lives, right? Because back then the EGFR inhibitors were developed for all comers. You know, there was a saying, I think it was picked it up from your podcast, everybody get a dose of Tarceva before they go to hospice. And I think Corey Langer, you did an interview with him and he had quotes. So I was driving to my, to work and I heard that was how it was discovered. The drugs were discovered before the targets were really found. And that general inhibition just doesn't work because it's not the right binding into the to the molecule. So the EGFR mutation discovery, and at the time Tom Lynch, along with a group in Dana-Farber. So Tom Lynch was at Mass General. Dana-Farber, they were sort of a close second. They had a publication in Science about 2 weeks later. And then MSK was also working on the same thing back then with Harold Varmus and William Pao and Vince Miller and others. And it was really three groups simultaneously showing the same thing. And that was around 2004, but it took until 2009 when the IPASS trial was published in the New England by Tony Mok, Yilong Wu, and others. And that was a Pan-Asian study, and EGFR mutant lung cancers were seen more common in Asian women who never smoked. And that they had an advantage in terms of enrolling these patients. And that led to a complete change of mindset in thoracic oncology. So the clinical trials were the ones that translated that discovery into clinical practice and saving lives. And of course, that then led to subsequent generations of EGFR inhibitors, as well as multiple generations of ALK inhibitors and ROS inhibitors. They all share the same mechanism of action. It's about this lock and key approach. If you find a mutation in the oncogene and that drives the oncoprotein into uncontrolled cell proliferation and metastasis, and you see that there is a cleft or a pocket in the oncoprotein and that you can fit a drug into it. And so to lock it up, so to speak, and it then this just suddenly stops that signal and then the cell just stops dividing and it dies. So that's the sort of concept behind original thought process in the targeted therapy world in lung cancer. However, things are now moving beyond that. So when we get to HER2, people have tried that lock and key approach, but it just hasn't worked out. It's actually been studied for about 20 years, ever since the trastuzumab revolution in breast cancer in the year 2000 or so. And for 20 years, we've not been able to develop a HER2 targeted therapy in lung cancer because firstly, the just replicating the trastuzumab trial from breast to lung didn't work out because they were different. And secondly, the incidence of HER2 expression and amplification, for example, is vastly different. The mechanisms are different. And the other aspect is the lock and key approach just doesn't work too well for HER2 mutations. At least the early generations of drugs didn't do a perfect bind. These were insertions in exon 20, and there's no pocket. It's a different shape, and you don't have a nice key that can just lock it up. So that's why the tyrosine kinase inhibitor trials have largely failed, whether it was neratinib or afatinib or dacomitinib, and we published those trials, and they were sort of showing some modest responses in the 10 to 20% range, but nothing outstanding, nothing that could beat chemotherapy, and therefore it's been disappointing. But to go beyond that, science of HER2 activation in lung cancers is seen as different. A lot of them were driven by mutations that are hyperactivated that leads to internalization of the tyrosine kinase and the receptor, the HER2 receptor. And in a way, without having too much HER2 protein on the cell surface, they kind of just go into the, they hyperactivate, they internalize into the cell, and then it gets recycled. So that, if you attach a antibody drug conjugate onto it, it literally just sucks the drug into the cell. You can see that ADCs can get into the cell through a variety of mechanisms. The traditional understanding is the one on the left-hand panel. You had lots of HER2 protein on the cell surface. You just need a lot more for the drug to bind and therefore get in. That's the traditional dogma. And that's why a lot of the very prominent scientists and physicians in this field have warned me, you're going to get a negative trial with the HER2 mutant story because there are not that many receptors on the cell surface. But my curiosity sort of prevailed, and we still did the trial anyway, and it was positive. So that then led to the second mechanism of action, where there are not that many receptors. There are always going to be some, but not amplified or overexpressed. And what they do is merely just sucking the drug actively into the cell, much more at a much more internalized rate than the wild type receptors. So we call that internalization through ubiquitination, but it's really literally just sucking the drug into the cell. And these mutants are very good at just internalizing the drug. And if you have a precision-guided missile with a warhead, with a powerful chemotherapy that is incompatible with life if you just give it naked, but if you pack it into the antibody and the cancer cells suck that drug into the cell, and then you release the bomb from within and kills the cancer cell, that kind of precision missile attack actually worked. And we initially found that in case reports. There were case series from Europe, Julian Maziers and others from France had published, and those were anecdotal. The lab evidence was lagging, so we decided there was some preclinical hypothesis that we came up with about this internalization theory, but it wasn't proven at the time. So we did concurrent lab and clinical research experiments. We then took the clinical practice back to the lab. So it's research to practice and back to the lab to research. And we can then label these antibody drug conjugates with those rhodamine dye, and we call it Frodo because it's pH-driven. And then they sort of glow in the dark, and then you can see the rate of internalization of these ADCs into the tumors. Here we were able to show the one that were labeled, the ADCs going into the cell in real time. So if you go to the next slide, we can then see the rate of internalization of these ADCs into the cell at different rates. So we call it sort of the trafficking index. That's how fast these drugs can get into the cell. So some of the cells that literally pull the drug into the cell and they traffic very quickly, and others are very slow at doing that. So that was sort of the mechanism of response that we looked at. And then we then took this to the clinic again, and that led to the DESTINY-Lung01 and the registrational trial approval just a few months ago. And there was a lot of skepticism at the time. This was 2014. That many HER2 experts who really spent their lifetime doing tyrosine kinase inhibitor cell signaling and lock and key approach, or people in breast cancer were really looking at the quantity of HER2, and it's driven by HER2 amplification and overexpression rather than mutation. The concepts are very different, and they just thought that the ADC approach is never going to work in HER2 mutants in lung cancer. So it came as a surprise when the T-DM1 trial was positive. And then that led to a lot of interest from biopharma industry to invest in this rather obscure field when it first started. And we saw, I mean, these are still 2% of lung cancer. You look at ROS1 and ALK, it's not that many more in terms of percentage incidence. We're talking thousands and thousands of patients every single year, just in the United States alone. So, and worldwide, it's a lot more patients. So then it led to some interest in this field, and then strengthening from the T-DM1 pilot study, which was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology back in 2018, we did a series of translational experiments that showed that this was not a fluke. This was a real effect that was replicated in cell lines, in mouse models, and some of the slides I put some pretty pictures there just for reference. And we then were able to guide the registrational trial of trastuzumab deruxtecan, which was first developed for HER2 amplified and then HER2 low breast cancer. But it's all largely due to protein expression, not mutations. But because of this internalization concept that we had published and shown subsequently, we doubled down on that in lung cancer. And that led to the registrational approval, the first targeted therapy for HER2. But it's a different mechanism. It's a smart bomb and precision missile compared to a lock and key approach.
So, and you know, it was interesting, the last ASCO meeting when we had the HER2 low data presented and Dr. LaRusso did the discussion and she brought up the issue of HER2 mutant disease. And when I would bring that up to the breast cancer docs, they were like, well, we hardly ever see it. And it was just kind of not a major issue for them. Even in GI cancer, where again, TDXD and HER2 positivity is a big issue, colon, upper GI, I think it's mainly overexpression there also. So as you say, it's a really different concept. First of all, can you just kind of maybe outline a little bit about, I guess, the epidemiology? Like what fraction of patients with, you know, non-small cell lung cancer have HER2 mutations as opposed to HER2 overexpression? For every patient with HER2 overexpression, how many are there with HER2 mutation? Is there like 10 times as many? It's a lot more, I guess.
Yeah. You're right. The epidemiology is different by disease. So compared to breast cancer, where 20% are HER2 amplified, which then produces the expression, the genetic aberration is amplification. And that's just increased gene copy number in breast and gastric. And I tell my patients or my fellows that this is like going to the old-fashioned photocopy. If they're a bit older, I can explain the photocopy machine. And you press on the button and you forget to let go. And then you're chatting away and you realize you copied 50 pages. And it was a total waste of money and paper and the environment. That is amplification. It's there's no difference in the genetic coding of the sequence, and basically it's the same thing, but copied again and again and again. We call a copy number gain, and when it gets to a certain threshold, we call it amplification. Mutation is different. It's not just the quantity of the protein that's been expressed or copied. It's the sequence is different. They've done an error. It's like they wrote the wrong thing. And the DNA sequence is wrong. And that could be wrong because you've switched a letter for another. So that's single nucleotide variation. Or you can write it wrong in the sense that you've inserted a list like 12 extra letters in between the sentence. So that's called an insertion. Or you can just delete some stuff which you forgot you deleted it, and that's a deletion. So these are so-called mutations. And that is different because the wording is different. The content has changed. But that change in content has led inadvertently to activation of the gene in uncontrolled fashion. So that's a slightly different concept. So you're not going to get too many copies. You're not going to get too much protein on the cell surface. You're just going to get a different HER2 that functions crazy. It just grows and divides and uncontrolled. It just functions wrong. But the number of copies of HER2 is still the same. So in that sense, in lung cancer, it's only about 2%. 2% are mutant in terms of all, total non-small cell lung cancer. In lung adenocarcinoma, probably 3%. And you do have a 1 to 2% incidence of HER2 amplification in lung cancer. So that does exist, but nowhere near as frequent as the 20% in breast and gastric cancers. So you have amplification in lung cancer and you have mutation in lung cancer. And according to our translational studies at Memorial Sloan Kettering and elsewhere, those two are largely separate targets. They represent different patient populations. There may be a small overlap in the order of 5 to 10%, but they're largely separate. The mutation cohort of patients tend to be younger people, often women, and often never smokers. And those are, it's a pretty, there's some analogy to EGFR mutation in terms of epidemiology, but it's not predominant Asian. There is no racial ethnic predominance for HER2. I've seen HER2 mutations across patients of all racial ethnic backgrounds, and it's not related to smoking. It's something in the environment that may have triggered it, or just a combination of multiple factors with a lot of bad luck. I've seen patients, there's no sort of single exposure that I can pinpoint. I've seen patients who have, you know, one of my earliest Australian patients came from a farm, was very clean air, was no industrial pollution, but he had HER2 mutant lung cancer and was pretty young as well. So that's, it's a different category of lung cancer. And that's about 2%. But when you talk about amplification, it's really a miscellaneous group of diseases in lung cancers. You do have the heavy smokers, and some of them have HER2 amplification. Some of them are squamous. But also up to a half of them actually have EGFR co-mutation. So you then have a HER2 driver and an EGFR driver. And often the HER2 initially thought to be a resistance mechanism to EGFR inhibitors, but subsequent research has shown that it's not always at resistance. Some of them had HER2 amplification at the outset. So you really have this molecular heterogeneity in HER2 in terms of its oncogenesis in lung cancer. So I categorize them as mutation as one group, amplification as another. And it's really the amplification that drives the high level of protein expression. And that's how I see them in terms of therapeutics, but also in terms of drug development and clinical trials.
Well, also there's the issue of the phenotype of the patient and some sort of corollary issues. So, you know, just to pick out one is, you know, sensitivity to immune checkpoint inhibitors. Actually, I think I saw a paper that you did looking at, I think it was HER2 mutant showing no responses. And that's kind of what we hear with ALK and EGFR. Is that the viewpoint, or is that the way you see HER2 mutant, you know, not necessarily very responsive to IOs? And then what about the HER2 amplified? Are they sensitive to IOs?
Yeah. Our early analysis of this group showed that the IO responses tend to be low compared to the general non-small cell lung cancer population. And it corroborated with the European experience with Julian Mazzia's Annals of Oncology, and that series had shown a 7% response rate. So it's not zero. Some of them do respond, but it's actually lower than what you expect with the general population. So single agent immune checkpoint inhibitors tend to reserve later line rather than upfront for HER2 mutants. There's a German series in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology that showed that if you do combination chemo-immunotherapy, they may do okay, but it's hard to tease out whether it's the chemo that did it or is it the immuno that did it. So we're in the process of running a randomized phase 3 trial of comparing first-line chemo-immunotherapy versus trastuzumab, deruxtecan, T-DXd in the first-line setting. And that, because it's such a rare mutation, we really had to get the world together to do this and to get meaningful time frame in terms of reading out results. So hopefully through international collaboration, we can get the results in the next couple of years to give us the answer for optimal first-line therapy.
It'll be interesting to see what happens there in terms of PD-1 levels. Maybe you can take a shot. I've asked a lot of people to explain to me, and I'm going to let you take your shot at it. Sort of the biology of not just HER2, but also EGFR. Like recently, yeah. I became aware that, am I right in saying that HER1 is actually EGFR? Yeah.
That's right.
So I didn't know that. But anyhow, it just reflects my lack of knowledge about that whole axis and HER3 and the fact that there's not a TKI. But anyhow, can you just sort of maybe explain it, you know, the way you explain it to fellows, your vision of that whole axis?
Yes, yes. Thank you. It's a good point you just made. Academics work in too many silos, and they don't necessarily talk to one another, and then you have different lingo coming out of their publications. So EGFR is HER1, and that's the neighbor of HER2. And HER2 is also called many things, HER2-new, ERBB2, and these are just because of different academic groups doing their own thing and calling their own things. And then in the scientific literature, it gets very confusing. And that's just an effect of different academic silos not collaborating well enough. But hopefully research to practice will inform and help break those silos so that we are talking about the same thing. Then that way we can advance this field of science in much expeditious fashion rather than keeping it, you know, to your chest and in your own little world. That's what academics have an inclination towards. And in the big picture, these are all so-called human epidermal growth factor family of receptors. So those are HER1, HER2, there's HER3, HER4, and they all act, they are all proteins on the cell surface. They serve as signaling growth factors so that the cells have to talk to each other with signals. And once you get a signal, the HER family of receptors are responsible for sending those signals into the nucleus of the cell for DNA replication. So they sort of control, and they have to do their job in terms of growing when you need to grow and stopping the growth when you don't need to grow, so we don't grow forever. So that's normal part of human biology. All our cells in our body have HER receptors on the cell surface. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to survive. But when the genetic codes of HER2 or HER1 or EGFR make a mistake, such as a mutation, an error in the coding, then those HER receptors, whether it's HER1 or HER2, can misbehave or just grow uncontrolled. And that's when it starts to send those signals down to the nucleus and telling that specific cancer cell to grow and divide. And meanwhile, the rest of the normal cells are still having normal HER2 or HER1. But the mutant cells in the cancer, they want to take control. So they grow and divide. So HER family is really integral, and it's been a very important target for cancer therapeutics. EGFR is certainly the poster child for lung cancer precision medicine, HER1, and HER2 is the poster child for breast cancer precision medicine with all the revolution since the days of trastuzumab, but certainly many iterations of trastuzumab-related therapy. And these have transformed lung cancer and breast cancer survival in really amazing ways. So that's the paradigm, and it's going back 20 years or so since the original discovery in the last century. And this is a continued area of investigation in so many other tumor types, because all the cells have HER receptors on the cell surface. And to the extent that we can give the right drug to the right patient, then we're going to make a difference. And that's why we're now seeing approvals in gastric cancer, now even in colon cancer with the trastuzumab tucatinib story in HER2-amplified colon cancer. And we hope to see many more other types of tumors that can be targeted with HER2-targeted therapy.
So we're going to be talking a lot about TDXD, of course, but I also, as long as we're talking about the sort of the HER and EGFR axis, wanted to ask you about HER3. We did a program with Dr. Passiani recently where I think I picked up a little more about this, but still trying to figure out. So you have an antibody drug conjugate, patritumab, that targets HER3. Like, in your mind, how does that work?
Yeah. So HER3 is another neighbor in the family. So you've got EGFR, HER1, and then you've got HER2. And HER3 and HER4 are next door neighbors who actually crosstalk with HER1 and HER2. So we call that process dimerization, when the two receptors bind together and they send signals to one another, reinforce the signaling down to the nucleus. Often, to send that signal, the way it's worked out is that the HER receptors need to talk to each other to send that signal. You can't send that signal alone. So it's either HER2 would talk to HER2, multiple HER2 receptors get together and send a joint signal to the nucleus to tell them to grow, and that's called homodimerization. And then if you have EGFR or HER1, same thing. And then HER1 will get together with HER2 or HER3. And then they decide, the two receptors decide to send a joint signal to the nucleus to grow. That's called heterodimerization. And it is really the HER1 and HER3 heterodimerization that is actually required for EGFR mutation signaling that lends itself a target for HER3 antibody drug conjugate. And remember, I said that when you activate through dimerization, that is, you actually ubiquitinate and internalize. So those receptors get sucked into the cell as you do so. So when you bind the cancer cell with a HER3 antibody drug conjugate like patritumab deruxtecan or HER3-DXd as they call it, then it binds to the HER1 and HER3 dimer. And that dimer will suck the drug into the cell. And that dimer is going to be more active if you're EGFR mutated to begin with, so that the HER3 will latch onto the HER3 and EGFR dimer, and then it gets sucked into the cell and releases the smart bomb and kills the cell in a totally different mechanism to EGFR inhibitors, which is the lock and key approach. And so you rather than switching it off with the lock and key, you're really just throwing a bomb into the cell and then blows it up with chemotherapy. Very different mechanism of action, and therefore it has the potential to overcome all types of resistance mechanisms to TKIs.
So within that model, what's your vision about how pertuzumab works in breast cancer, for that matter, how trastuzumab works?
Yeah, so trastuzumab is naked antibody without the warhead. So it doesn't have the smart bomb. So it's a missile, but it doesn't have the bomb. So it's a very different molecule. What it does is it's got multiple mechanisms of action. And to this day, I don't think anyone's really crystal clear in terms of how trastuzumab has produced its wonders in so many patients. It certainly has signal inhibition capability. So it basically binds to the HER2 protein and tries to tell it to stop. So it's antibody inhibition. So it sends a rather weak signal on its own to reduce the signal for growth. But more importantly, it actually elicits an immune response, ADCC. And that's certainly part of the innate immune system, but it's antibody dependent, you know, cell-mediated cellular cytotoxicity. And that will localize the enemy with HER2 and then elicit these antibody responses that are cell-mediated. And then we can really elicit a long-term response through that ADCC mechanism in the long term. And that's thought to be the main mechanism of action for these 10-year survivors of, you know, metastatic breast cancer on trastuzumab, you know, 10, 15 years. And then you get into the Neil Love question of when do you stop, when do you continue? But you're really relying on an immune response in that sense. It's not so much the chemo that's doing the work. And certainly there's synergy with chemo as well, which may actually elicit that immune response. And that's why in breast cancer, you have to give it with chemotherapy. A naked antibody alone it doesn't cut it in terms of response rate and survival. So in lung cancer, the early days of trastuzumab-based clinical trials have been done since the trastuzumab revolution, but all six trials were negative, including a randomized phase two trial that was published by Dr. Gates-Meyer in Annals of Oncology. This was early days in the beginning of this century. And it was all negative, but the patient selection was very different. It was really looking at HER2 expression. But we know that expression tends to be low in lung cancer, not as high in breast. It's not as frequent to get amplification. And in the subgroup analysis, they saw a signal in HER2 amplified cancers, but there were only like six patients, so it's hard to draw any conclusions. So therefore, it's the difference in molecular epidemiology that actually pretty much guaranteed a failure of these trials, even though they were done in good faith, replicating the breast story into lung. But the epidemiology was different, and therefore the trial design was flawed, and they failed. But I do see a role in trastuzumab and pertuzumab in the longer-term future when it's done in combination with other medicines. So the trastuzumab pertuzumab story is certainly the Cleopatra trial a decade ago, and then many other improvements since have been the mainstay of therapy, even this day in first-line metastatic breast cancer, you know, HER2 target therapy. But in lung cancer, we've seen the MyPathway study showing some response in the 10 to 20% range with trastuzumab, pertuzumab, not enough to do the serious damage on HER2 mutants. But we are seeing some signal of activity. So I believe it's the weak effect of the of those antibodies on inhibition and then eliciting an immune response that may still be targeting. And I think in the long term, you really have to learn from the breast cancer docs. You give it with chemo to elicit the immune response, and that may actually give more better long-term outcomes. And there are trials ongoing. Certainly one was already published last year with Dr. Julian Mazias in the JCO. On giving trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and a taxane chemotherapy. And it showed just under 30% response rate, which is better. It's an improvement compared to naked antibody approaches. And in the future, I believe there may be more combinations that could be exploited to render a more durable response. I'm not sure about the tucatinib combination in lung cancer. We've certainly tried that with afatinib and lapatinib, and it hasn't really panned out very well. But the jury's still out. And certainly you can leverage that, the same rationale about the immune response in antibody drug conjugates, which all contain trastuzumab. So there's certainly an area of investigation combining them with immune checkpoint. Perhaps the innate immune system can have an interplay with the adaptive immunity of T cells with the IO checkpoint inhibitors combined. And there's a body of preclinical work showing that ADCs can actually prime the adaptive immunity and render itself to better response. This is an area of my investigation as well, especially after giving ADCs. Can you mount an immune response, turning a cold tumor to hot, so to speak, and then render them respond? Knowing that these tumors don't classically respond, but maybe you can turn that into a hot tumor and then respond. I've actually done that in some of my patients, and I'm very pleased that some of my patients are having long-term response to immune checkpoints with HER2 mutation, but done in this sequence of doing a bit of ADC priming and then giving immune checkpoints later on. And you know, some of them are just responding for 5+ years and disease-free. They were on the verge of death initially. But I'm not replicating it in every patient, so certainly more translational research needs to be done, and a lot of thought process needs to be put in terms of clinical trial design to maximize these immune effects of trastuzumab-related targeted therapy.
Yeah, you hear about ADCs and IOs in different situations, like in bladder cancer. They're all excited about and ADC and enfortumab vedotin plus IO. They think that's going to be, and it kind of makes sense because it's really in a way chemo plus IO, which you know, lung cancer really define that. Let's talk a little bit about what we know about ADCs in lung cancer. You mentioned T-DM1, and I remember there was a paper, but I think Greg Raleigh was involved with it, and I didn't think it was all that impressive. But did they see objective responses with T-DM1?
Yeah, so there were actually quite a few papers on this. Firstly, the international trial of T-DM1 wasn't that impressive. It was published in Clinical Cancer Research with Solange Peters and Tom Stinchcomb and many others, and it showed a 0% response in HER2 2+ and a very low response rate in HER2 3+, but maybe a signal in these amplified cases with T-DM1. So that was the paper. It was a negative study, but maybe some signal finding that warrant further investigation. The Japanese trial published by Dr. Hoda et al. In Journal of Thoracic Oncology, also around 2018, also was pretty negative, but it was kind of, the selection was all comers, was expression, amplification, mutation, the mutants responded, but the response rate in total was pretty low because it was a mixed bag of, and it was small numbers to begin with, so hard to draw conclusions. And then our investigator-sponsored trial at Memorial Sloan Kettering, it's a cohort in the basket trial of TDM1, which I had led. And in fact, that was a project that was served the basis of my fellowship training going from Australia to New York at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And that was translating the breast cancer discovery into lung cancer. And that was also the basis for my fellowship, a basis for the ASCO Young Investigator Award at the time. And that cohort in HER2 mutants actually was read positive. So we had a 44% response rate. We had a median progression-free survival of 5 months. And this was in heavily pretreated patient populations, often third, fourth, fifth line of therapy with prior chemo, prior HER2 targeted therapy and prior IO. So these patients really had nothing left to give except maybe some chemotherapy like vinorelbine or something. So that's thought to be an encouraging signal, but small numbers. And that's what's led the subsequent investigations and investment into this HER2 mutant patient population, a rather obscure field of thoracic oncology at the time. But now it's certainly created a new paradigm.
So let's talk a little bit about TDXD. First, can you talk about kind of the way you know, maybe explain to your fellows sort of what it is, how it's built, you know, the double payload delivery, and why it's different than other ADCs we've seen?
Yeah. So this is a new antibody drug conjugate compared to TDM1. It's the same trastuzumab backbone, but it has a different warhead, and it's DXD in terms of DM1. And DXD is a irinotecan-like, it's a substance, but it's much more potent. It's a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor, and it's certainly much more potent than DM1. And also, we can pack a lot more warheads into the same missile. So the so-called drug-to-antibody ratio is twice compared to TDM1. You can just pack a lot of bombs in the smart bomb, so per molecule. And then the linker, linking the warhead to the missile, is also a slightly different linker in terms of engineering. So it is a cleavable linker rather than non-cleavable. Cleavable meaning that it can easily break off and then release the bomb with ease within the cell. And that also has membrane permeability. So the drugs can the toxins can penetrate from one cell to the neighboring cell to the neighboring cell rather than being confined within the cell membrane. So it can penetrate the membrane and kill neighboring cells. So we call that so-called bystander effect. And that may be responsible for some of the pneumonitis and interstitial lung disease that we can see with trastuzumab deruxtecan. But it certainly has given it more advantage in terms of killing HER2 mutant tumors. Even with some tumor heterogeneity, it can still go around and kill neighboring cancer cells. So with all those differences in bioengineering, it is certainly a more potent ADC against this target. And we have seen activity in the TDM1 resistant HER2 positive breast cancers initially, and now certainly the Destiny Breast 03 and other trials have shown that it's superior to TDM1 even in the second line setting. So similarly in lung cancer, we did the initial phase 1 trial in HER2 mutant, knowing that, borrowing from the TDM1 story, which I had the opportunity of leading together in collaboration with Greg Riley and many others at Memorial Sloan Kettering, just borrowing that concept and then to develop TDXD or Enhertu or trastuzumab deruxtecan, we were able to hone in on the HER2 mutants. And in the phase 1 trial that we published in Cancer Discovery, this is Suratani et al., in 2020, cancer discovery. And we showed that all comers, it was only a 28% response rate. But in the HER2 mutant lung cancer cohort, we had a more than 70% response rate. Small numbers, but very encouraging signal when you hone in on HER2 mutants with this more potent ADC. And that led to the DESTINY-Lung01 trial, which we did as a phase two. And this was launched in 2018, but we've published that earlier last year, just about a year ago, in the New England Journal of Medicine. And as Dr. LaRusso had pointed out in the ASCO plenary discussion, that case with the in the waterfall, the one with the complete response on the right-hand side, actually was HER2-0 in terms of protein expression. So it actually has nothing to do with the protein. Back to the photocopier, you know, making lots of copies of HER2. It's got nothing to do with that. It's the function of HER2 mutation that sucks the drug into the cell that made a difference. So they had to be activated and mutated. And that trial, and then, of course, a little bit of dose tweaking. The 6.4 milligram per kilogram was thought to be too high. We did DESTINY-Lung02, which compared that with a lower dose and found that that lower dose was just as effective but less toxic. And that was subsequently served as the basis for FDA approval just a few months ago in August of 2022. And so that's the story going back about a decade or so behind the use of antibody drug conjugates targeting HER2 mutant lung cancer. It's the first ADC to be approved in lung cancer, but we are hoping that this creates a new paradigm of a new class of drug that could be helpful for patients with lung cancer.
I thought I understood ADCs until T-DXd came along. So first of all, you mentioned DESTINY-03 breast, where, you know, way better outcome than T-DM1. So one ADC versus another, huge difference. And then the HER2 low, you know, Dr. Modi presented at ASCO. Again, you know, you think of targeted therapy. Now all of a sudden, well, wait a minute. I'm not sure what the target is. I think I've seen some data even with responses in HER2-0. You have the TROPE ADCs that, even though not everybody has TROPE, everybody seems to respond. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of confusion, at least on my mind, a little bit about, you know, sort of what these agents are and sort of where they're heading.
Yeah, I think it's confusing for investigators and scientists as well. So we're all learning in uncharted waters. There are two drug development pathways for ADCs. One is the precision pathway, which is personally my preferred way of developing drugs. You really want to bring the best drug to the right patient for maximal outcomes. But that's usually a small slice of the pie, a small percentage of patients. And that approach has its pros and cons. The HER2 mutant story is the prototype for that. And I hope to develop more for HER2 amplification and many other targets down the track. But there's another drug development pathway for ADCs, and that's using it as just a chemotherapy. So it's given to everybody, like nab-paclitaxel, right? So you give it to everybody. And you know, you're not going to aim for a precision medicine type of response rate or duration of response, but you're going to aim for like a docetaxel-like response, maybe slightly better, and then they can get a drug approval in the later line setting. And that's a strategy that's currently being developed for TROP2, and there's CEA-CAM and many other ADCs that are emerging in the lung cancer and other solid tumor space. And they don't necessarily need a companion diagnostic or a biomarker to select patients, because they're just going to give you like a 20% response rate. And then, you know, in the refractory setting, arguably it's better than nothing. And even though the duration of response may not be super high, but overall it's something. And there may still be a drug development and approval strategy in that population. Personally, it's rather unsatisfactory to do it like that, because it feels like you're going backwards. You've got all these engineering, and then you're going back to the old days of chemo, a more expensive version of chemo. Certainly, I can understand the company push to do so, but as an oncologist, I'd like to really see a lot more precision, especially in this day and age of technological transformation, to do some work honing in on the biomarkers of response, really find out it's got to be more than just IHC and mutation. There's a lot more ADC biomarkers that need to be uncovered to really select the right patients who may respond to the right ADC. So I think the jury's still out in terms of where the future of ADCs will be. But certainly I'm hoping for a more precision drug development pathway.
Yeah, and I think that idea also ties into, I was kind of confused when I started to see the data looking at dose that you just referred to in lung cancer. The study where you increase the dose, you just saw more toxicity and not greater efficacy. We had a couple of cases presented at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting by a doc actually from New York in the community where he gave TDXD to HER2-low patients who were like 90 and 91 years old, and he decided to start at a low dose and escalate them up, although I don't even know if that's been done. But you kind of were starting to, again, it sounds like you said, a little bit like chemo and how it's been approached. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. In fact, we've looked at the data closely in the phase one dose escalation study. So in that study, you know, we started with low dose and we then dose escalated to 4.4, 5.4, 6.4, and even 7.4. So we milligram per kilogram, and we saw that the highest dose was too much. It was a lot of toxicity. We had patients who just, you know, get one dose. They're big. Big, strong, muscular men who get one dose and they're laying in bed for the whole week and they're having constant diarrhea and so forth. It's just not compatible. So we pushed it back and their dose de-escalated. And then in the phase one trial, we came back with the two recommended phase two trials, which led to the confusion. There was 5.4 and 6.4. And there were arguments on both sides. And so both were RP2D. In breast cancer, they're a lot more exquisite in terms of chemosensitivity. So a 5.4 dose was pursued because they thought that some investigators and the drug developers thought that, you know, you don't need too much dosing for breast, so you'd get away with 5.4. And that was right. I had always argued for 5.4, but there's also another in lung. But there's a school of thought that lung cancers are more chemo refractory. They're not chemosensitive, and therefore you need a stronger dose. And there's a no pain, no gain kind of concept. So 6.4 was pursued, but evidently the DESTINY-Lung02 had proven that 5.4 is just as good and less toxic. So I think you do get into like a plateau effect. There is a dose response relationship, just like chemotherapy, but because it's through a targeted delivery mechanism, it's not always the more the merrier. So you get into a 5.4, even 4.4. A lot of my patients in the early days of drug development have been dose reduced to 4.4, and they're still responding today. So for many years. So I think a lot of it may be eliciting an immune response long term, and the dose really doesn't matter when you get to that point. So it's not, yeah, it is treated like a chemo, but it shouldn't. It's not exactly the same.
Well, the other thing, and when I first started hearing this from the breast people, I'm not so sure in terms of lung and GI, but I started to hear about like alopecia, GI effects. I think the PI actually says you should give preemptive GI meds for that. What have you observed in lung cancer in terms of those issues?
Yeah, it is certainly it's variable per patient. I've had patients who had no problems and others who just like they're really miserable. And it mirrors some chemotherapies, and some can produce really horrible side effects, and others sort of get along, go about with life. So I tend to use palonosetron in the and dexamethasone as a chemotherapy pre-medication, just like if I'm to give carboplatin. So they're moderately immunogenic, and in some I don't routinely give fosaprepitant, but you can. And when you do that, you're going to constipate some patients. So that could offset some of the diarrhea effects. So I don't tend to give loperamide like you do for neratinib and some TKI, afatinib and other TKIs. I don't tend to do that. I find that most patients wouldn't need it if they get enough antiemetics. But certainly diarrhea is possible, and we have to account for that and manage it with supportive medicines at the earliest instance.
So you talked about the first line trial that you're doing, and earlier you were talking about the IPASS study, which again, for people new to oncology, that was really the first study that compared targeted therapy to chemo. Then they did some stuff like that in ALK, and they stopped doing that, and if people had response rates of 50-60%, people just started using a first line like in RET, et cetera.
Yeah.
But again, this is a little bit different. So globally, when you look at T-DXd and HER2 mutant lung cancer, first of all, what are you seeing in terms of response rate and also duration of response? And how does that compare to what you see with osimertinib or, you know, the ALK inhibitors?
Yeah, certainly. The mechanism of action is quite different compared to the EGFR TKIs. So there are some corollary, some areas of similarity, but overall, I don't think they can be judged the same way. And it is kind of like a smart targeted chemotherapy. So I'd see it like a precision chemotherapy, so to speak. And the response rates have been about 50 to 60%. And interestingly, I'm seeing some immune effects. Some of my patients, you know, even treated off protocol, some of them respond very quickly in the first scan and get a partial response. But some of my patients actually get stable disease for a year and a half, and then they start to get the partial response. And then I had a patient 2 years out, and he's got a complete response. So those are not the same as classic targeted therapy mechanisms. You know, you take the TKI, and then you have this resurrection effect from the ICU that you tend to see with this lock and key approach of tyrosine kinase inhibitors. This is more chemotherapy. It's a slow, gradual response, but then there's this immune component that can come later, and then you get this meltdown of tumors. So I think they're different. So I don't just look at the response rate. You have to look at the full picture. And the full picture is certainly looking promising. In a refractory setting, you're seeing a median PFS or progression-free survival of about 8 months. You get a median duration response of 9 months. But this is in heavily pretreated refractory setting. If you bring it to first line, just like what we saw with DESTINY-Breast03, you may get much better outcomes in terms of progression-free survival. And interestingly, in the Breast03 study, we also saw less toxicity if you give it up front rather than give it really later on. You know, there were no treatment-related deaths. The toxicities were much better managed. So if you give it early line, of course, you learn how to manage the toxicities over time. So that's also made a difference. But we are hoping in DESTINY-Lung01, we're going to see some similar improvements in outcomes if you give it first line rather than in a chemo refractory setting. And if it's a smart chemotherapy, you know, you really want to give it earlier on rather than when the drug is getting resistant. So there's some hope that this would be superior to even chemotherapy and pembrolizumab in the first line setting if we choose the right patient population. So, but the jury's still out. We'll still have to complete the study.
And in that study, first of all, do you allow pembro alone for high PD-1, or they have to get pembro chemo?
It's pembro chemo, just to keep it homogeneous, so you don't have too many biases. And also, there's a school of thought, you know, in HER2 mutant, they're all HER2 mutant. So regardless of PD-L1 expression, maybe the response is going to be slightly lower with single agent IO, and therefore we give chemo IO. That's the thought process at trial design. There's a lot of debate about this, and I could easily see this going into a Neil Love point-counterpoint session when you have investigators debating. There's no hard answer to this yet.
And in the T-DXd arm, it's just T-DXd, not with an IO. There's not a third arm. So just straightforward, because, I'm sure you debated that too.
Yeah, we'd also discussed about the IO combo, but there's a school of thought to keep the trial simple, not to ask too many questions in one trial. Just keep it simple, get a straight answer. Otherwise, you get too many confounders and so forth. And it's also a difficult trial to accrue because it's 2%. Not everyone gets HER2 testing routinely. And therefore, it'll, you know, if you get too many arms, it's going to be twice as long to complete.
Absolutely. Yeah, that'll be really interesting. When do you think we're going to get a readout on that?
So I'm hoping to so I presented the trial design last year in ASCO. That's just without just that through reporting that we started the trial, we started enrolling and it's going well and the design. But I'm hoping maybe by preliminary, maybe next year. I don't know for sure, but it really depends. It's also difficult to accrue in the first line setting because patients are, when they're diagnosed, they're understandably anxious. They want to get onto a treatment quickly, and the trial, you know, you always have to test for the mutation, and not everyone gets upfront HER2 testing, and it takes a long time to get NGS back. So at Memorial Sloan Kettering, we've rolled out a reflex PCR testing for all patients with non-small cell lung cancer just to catch those 2% of patients who may benefit. And that takes a few days. But if you do NGS or liquid biopsies or at MSK, we use MSK Impact, that all takes a couple of weeks. And then you got to identify that. Then you start the consent process. And you got trial eligibility screening and then enrollment and then treatment. So that is all time. So it's sometimes hard for patients to wait that long and to get onto the trial. So it's somewhat difficult from that. There are some logistical hurdles. But as we were talking earlier with the Bloomberg New Economy International Cancer Coalition, you're really trying to work together across stakeholders to simplify clinical trials, make it a less cumbersome process for patients to get on, to provide access more to community patients in the community and community oncologists through maybe a decentralized trial model or a hub and spoke model that we published in Nature Medicine. We described it through that collaborative model. We may be able to bring innovation to patients, not only in academic centers, but across the board in community. And that serves that disparity concept that you have talked about earlier on. It's really disparity and equity, from my standpoint, is not only for social justice, but it's also, which is important on its own, but in my world of curing cancer, it's absolutely critical to engage all patients. Then you can accelerate the accrual. You know, my TDXD first line trial, if done in a really diversified, collaborative manner, and bringing it to the patient, we can accrue like wildfire. You ask me, when's the readout? You know, with that approach, maybe this ASCO, you know, if we can do it properly, with true international collaboration, we're going to accelerate the timeline of drug discovery and approvals. And then you fast track that to all trials. You're going to see the cure for cancer, you know, so it'll keep you very busy with the podcasts. It's really something that I can see happening if we get it right through collaboration. Because many of my patients with metastatic lung cancer, you know, thought to be a death sentence, you know, just not that many years ago, they're living 5-10 years out. You know, I'm seeing these patients who have complete response. Many are in NED. You do a scan, there's no evidence of disease. They have brain and spine metastasis to begin with. But I just monitor some patients, you know, with a scan every 3 to 6 months. And they're not cured because they can come back because of metastatic disease from the outset. But, you know, they get on with their lives. So that's sort of, it's not a complete cure, but I think we're getting closer and closer to the cure for cancer. But we have to do the clinical trials right. And that's the issue that we're currently encountering. You know, what if everyone in the world with HER2 mutations will get a notification on their app? And it's optional. You've got to protect their privacy and confidentiality and everything. But there are ways to do that. You get an app and you tell them, where are the HER2 trials, first line, second line? And then we work with the local oncologist to bring that medicine to the patient. So we published a study a few years ago in JAMA Oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering. You know, we already show that more than about three quarters of patients, and some studies quoting higher figure, are treated in the community. Patients want to get their care close to home. They don't want to travel thousands of miles and jump through hoops and stay in a hotel and wait in the waiting room of academic centers. They want to continue their life. So they want to be treated locally. But the trials are often not available to because it's so complicated. And community docs are busy. You know, they're busy enough treating patients. So then you get suboptimal care because we know that clinical trials are widely recognized as the best care of patients with cancer. But we're not making them easily accessible and available to patients. So by doing that, leveraging the community docs, which your enterprise has vast networks of access to community docs. You know, if we can rev them up and then we change the equation and change the rules of clinical trials, make them to be the key players, the leaders on clinical trials with support. And there's a lot of industry funding in oncology research, and we can easily hire an NP or a PA, you know, to support clinical trials in community practices. To support the community docs, then together, you know, through a collaborative model, you know, we can really accelerate these trials to completion and therefore the cure for cancer.
You know, I was telling you about this disparity presentation we did. One of the things that we did, because every now and then we also do programs where we interview patients, and I showed a short clip from an interview I did of a patient with myeloma who'd been on the bispecific antibody teclistamab for a year and a half, doing great, responding, no symptoms. And the day that I interviewed him was the day it got approved. And he'd been on it for a year and a half. Not only that, it was approved as fifth-line therapy. He got it as, like, second-line therapy. So it was, like, just a classic example of the advantage of being in clinical trials. Anyhow, getting back to TDXD, I think you referred to the fact that one thing I was going to curious about, and one of the reasons I asked you, I know it's different than ALK and EGFR, but also from the point of view of docs and practice, it's different. To me, it looks like the responses aren't as long. You said 9 months, I know, you know, 8 or 9 months, yeah. which sounds shorter than like what you see with EGFR and ALK. Is that the case?
Yes, it depends on the chemosensitivity of the disease. So in breast cancer, you're seeing a bit longer than that. And also it's longer if you give it upfront in the first or second line setting rather than fourth and fifth line. So I think those numbers can change depending on the clinical context. And we're hoping that DESTINY-Lung04, which is the first line trial, will produce superior outcomes. But the jury's still out. And it's really a chemotherapy delivery system, so it's a bit different to the tyrosine kinase. So I can't really equate one with the other. You can probably, you know, borrow, you know, EGFR, ALK, ROS1, RET. These are very similar in terms of their action, but of mechanism of action. But ADCs are very different, and I therefore randomized control trials still play an important role.
All right, so let's tackle the elephant in the room, ILD. And, of course, we talk about this all the time with the breast and the GI people. And, you know, our discussions with the lung people are a little different. I don't know whether it's because there's so much, you know, pulmonary issues already with the typical lung cancer patients because they smoked and COPD or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know. I kind of get the feeling that the lung people aren't as concerned about it. But anyhow, I know you've been very involved. You know, we did a whole program where we work with a pulmonologist trying to dissect out the whole issue of ILD. So can you talk about what's been seen in the lung cancer trials in terms of ILD in comparison to what's been seen with breast and GI? And for practical purposes right now, and incidentally, you got your first line trial, but you know, we have our way of doing stuff is we just go out to 25 investigators and say, well, let's put the reimbursement aside. What would you like to do? And I'll tell you that half of your colleagues right now would like to give TDXD first line.
Yeah, yeah. It shows the historical perspective of thoracic oncology. You know, we favor targeted therapy over chemo. So that's the right. Almost a dogmatic approach to things. You've got a targeted therapy, you've got a target, and that's the way to go. So I think there, and personally, I feel the same way, but I just need to put it to a trial to prove it so that we do it right, because you can get it wrong. And it's a different mechanism of action to the pill, tyrosine kinase inhibitors. In terms of ILD, it's not benign. It could be certainly fatal. Our Destiny-Lung01 trials had reported the fatality. So did most TDXD trials, except Destiny-Breast03, which gave it early line with extensive education and early intervention program that actually made the difference. So we are hoping to improve upon that that statistic. You know, in the Destiny-Lung01 trial, we're seeing about a 13% rate of pneumonitis and ILD. So, you know, you largely can say 10 to 15% is sort of the ballpark. But we're hoping to reduce that number. Most of them are benign, are pretty mild, grade 1 and grade 2, about half of them. But some are serious. So you've got to, I would say that 75% we can say are manageable. They're usually treatable, lower grade. But there is this 25% of ILD that is potentially serious, and you might need hospitalization, and you might need intravenous steroids, and if you intervene early, it's good, but if late, it could be fatal. Thoracic oncologists are kind of used to doing this with IO-related, immune-related pneumonitis. You know, it was once upon a time very scary as well, and we had lots of education workshops and CME how to manage immune checkpoint, lots of guidelines being published. And I had participated in some of them in the early days, but I can still remember back then there was a lot of fear, but now it's bread and butter for us as thoracic oncologists. And we're used to people who are coming with oxygen tanks, with COPD and all that. And you know that these patients are higher risk, but we still give immune checkpoint inhibitors. So we're kind of accustomed to that sort of high risk population and managing it. In a way, it's not that much different in terms of TDXD, ILD management. It's early recognition and early intervention with steroids and oxygen. So if we get that, if we learned how to do that with immune checkpoint pneumonitis, then the thoracic oncology docs are a little bit more comfortable dealing with it in the ADC context.
So I think I figured out the algorithm to detect ILD in the breast cancer people. I think, first of all, their approach is if you pick it up when it's asymptomatic, then theoretically you can re-challenge. If you pick them up when they have symptoms, they're done. Does that algorithm apply to lung cancer?
Yeah, generally that's the same algorithm that we're using across the Destiny trials. And we recently published an algorithm in Cancer Treatment Reviews with Sandra Swain as first author.
Right.
And so that's sort of serve as some guide, just like the early days of IO pneumonitis, which is actually quite similar. In IO pneumonitis, you re-challenge when they're asymptomatic, if you have patches or you have very mild symptoms. But if you're hospitalized, if it's got severe complications, then you really think twice about re-challenging.
So it's not necessarily that easy to read those kind of papers and figure out like what you're supposed to do. So the other issue is imaging. So again, the breast people right now are saying we're trying to get imaging every 8 or 9 weeks, maybe for a long time, even if they don't need the imaging because of their metastatic disease, because we want to pick this up asymptomatic. Again, is that kind of the way you see it going in lung?
Yeah, on the trial, we're seeing it every 6 weeks with imaging. That's mandated by the trial for that very reason of picking it up. But in standard practice, I tend to do it initially perhaps every 2 to 3 cycles, but over time, every 3 to 4 is perfectly appropriate. And if the patient is asymptomatic, they got their pulse oximeter at home, and I'm checking everything, I don't think that you know, too frequent scanning is a bit of a burden for patients. And I don't think there's great evidence saying that if you just hold the drug at the earliest onset of a little patch that are non-specific, it could be that you just had, you know, you had a flu or you had COVID, and you don't know. You can really, you can't work it out on the CT scan. Then what do you do? So there's a lot of unknowns in that context. I think on clinical trials, you've got to be very vigilant. But in standard practice, I think it has to be a bit more personalized. I wouldn't be as dogmatic. Yes, you do need CT monitoring every few cycles, whether it's every two or every four. I think it depends on the patient.
So I know if we present a patient at one of our breast cancer programs who already has some kind of lung problem, they get very, very nervous about using TDXD because they don't see it that much. Most breast cancer patients don't have pre-existing lung problems. Yet most of your patients do. So again, how does the trial handle prior COPD and other cardiopulmonary problems? And clinically, what do you do when you want to use, you have a HER2 mutant situation, but yet the patient's got maybe even symptomatic COPD?
Yeah. So those cases, it's a risk-benefit ratio discussion with the patient. The same could apply with IO checkpoint, which can cause pneumonitis in a fair number of patients. And if they have COPD and they're on oxygen and they have like a one lung, do you give it or do you just let them go? I mean, that is a question that we have to individually discuss with the patient. But in my experience, it's not an absolute contraindication. And there are instances where the cancer is going to imminently kill you in the next few weeks unless you do something about it. And you got this drug, you got a shot, it's a double-edged sword. Do you give it a shot or do you just let yourself go? I mean, that the patient needs to make that decision together with the oncologist. But I don't see this as an absolute contraindication, particularly coming from a lung cancer perspective where they all have some lung condition. So I think that speaks to the uncertainty and the experience from the different subspecialties. And it's again a reflection of different silos and different ways of thinking. In breast, their lungs are healthy, breast cancer community, and the earliest incidence of any lung condition, they get frightened about it. And it's the uncertainties can produce a lot of fear, not only in patients, but among oncologists as well. But the thoracic oncologists are much more used to doing this. So there's a lot more comfort level. And I think you can learn from one specialty to another. And that, you know, to give a plug to community oncologists who see different a variety of different clinical contexts and tumor types, they can get a better appreciation of what's clinically important. And some of them are clinically significant, but many of those concerns are not. So I think we need to take a step back and hear what, like what you're doing, hearing from different points of view, and then take a balanced view on this. But my approach to TDXD pneumonitis is very similar to my approach to IO checkpoints.
You bring up the general medical oncologist who's hearing from the GI people, they're hearing from the lung people, hearing from the breast. One of the things they hear from the GI people that they don't hear from you and they don't hear from the breast is the GI, you can ask Dr. Janjigian, they're all into repeating HER2. So if they're HER2 positive and then they'll do another assay when they progress or something, and if they're HER2 zero, then they don't use the HER2. Whereas breasts, once you're HER2, they'll just keep using it. Again, any thoughts about retesting in lung cancer?
Yeah. So if it's HER2 mutant, it's like EGFR mutation. They tend to stay, so they don't go away. It's an oncogenic driver. It's constitutively active, and I wouldn't need to retest it for the sake of checking if it's still there. But I would do the repeat biopsy and NGS just to look for resistance mechanisms that may emerge and that may be targeted with new therapeutics. So I do a lot of rebiopsy from more for a clinical research and clinical trial matching point of view, but not so much for the HER2 mutation testing. And with amplification, things can be a lot more heterogeneous. And it sounds like the loss of HER2 is a big thing in gastric, but not so much in breast.
Yeah, that's a great point, though, about the mutations. That's really interesting. Let me ask you, do you envision in the future that maybe there's going to be a pan-tumor approval of, say, T-DXd for just HER2 mutant disease in general, regardless of the primary?
That's a great question. And in fact, this is the concept for the Pan-Tumor01 clinical, the Destiny Pan-Tumor01, which I had presented the design a couple of years ago to ASCO, and we just completed accrual. And the jury's still out. We have to do some data analysis properly. And this is specifically looking at the HER2 mutant solid, different types of solid tumors. This is a pretty simple design. You know, if it's a same drug, you give it in an oncogene selected patient population across multiple tumor types that are not lung cancer, because we've already got an approval for lung. So we're looking at biliary tract cancers and colorectal cancers and breast cancers that are HER2 mutant but not amplified or expressed, and ovarian cancers, and then we're looking at responses in those. And this is a trial with a pan-tumor approval in mind. And whether that's going to pan out or not, we'll have to give it a little bit of time. But I'm hoping to see read out the results much sooner. Because we had completed accrual. So this is a very important study that could open up a new indication for patients with different, not just lung cancer, but many different types.
Yeah, the oncologists are all over that. We actually had a general medical oncologist who presented, and we're doing a GYN program, two cases of cancer of the endometrium. Now, I didn't ask whether there's HER2 mutant or HER2 overexpressed, but the doc gave both patients T-DXd. One had a CR, the other one had a good PR. So I got a feeling people are going to start doing that before your trial's reported, but it'd be great to get the data.
Yeah. That's very encouraging to hear. And certainly I'm going to feed that back to my co-investigators on this study to really try to push this paradigm forward. It's a little bit difficult to tease out because now you have HER2 low breast cancer approval. So is it driven by the mutation or is it driven by the low protein? And sometimes a lot of biomarker analysis needs to be done. But that this is an important new concept, and it could deliver a breakthrough drug for many, many patients in need. And you just cited some examples of clearly some lives being saved. The Destiny Lung-04 is still a little bit of time away, and this is an international trial that we're doing across North America, in Latin America, Asia, and Europe. So that's what it takes to accrue to a study of this size, and this is in a rare tumor population, arguably not commonly tested. Most oncology practices do not test for HER2 unless it's a part of a broad NGS panel, which takes time to get results.
One of the things I like about this is that you could really get equipoise about either arm. I don't see a problem randomizing somebody on a trial like this. I think it's really hard to predict which one's going to be better for me. I think most people would be fine with it.
Yeah, exactly. Because they still, if you get chemo, we can still give them T-DXd later on, so you can get the best of both worlds. And most patients are actually very happy to go to do this. And if this could be, I mean, the trial's already started, but I'm just using it as an example of such trials. And many of such trials are going to happen in the future. If we can broaden access to community oncologists and make trials a reality, not just in the academic centers where you're only seeing a quarter of patients, but broaden it to the three quarters of patients who are seeing in the community, that's going to lead to a sea change in terms of the pace of breakthroughs, and also the ability to collaborate internationally. Because if I can collaborate with someone in Nebraska in a community oncology, and we can, you know, through telemedicine and through Zoom, and you can connect to all corners of the world, you know, if there's Wi-Fi, and we could definitely do a lot of the monitoring also remotely. You still have to have a very good local oncologist, and that's essential. No technology is going to be able to replace that, but you empower that oncologist with technology, with resources. We can really do a lot. So I'm hoping that the Neo Love network of oncologists could also be empowered to do their part and lead trials in that regard.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Lee, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neo Love for Oncology Today.